up counsel. I'm up counsel for the law firm Cronish Lee, Wader & Halvin, where I've been for 22 years. And before that, for about 20 years, a partner at a firm called Paletti, Frieden, Brashka, Feldman, and Gartner. And before that, for a period of about 8 years, a partner in a firm called, at one point, Landis, Brenner, Feldman, and Riley, and at one point, Landis, Feldman, Riley, and Akers. The Landis being Dean Landis, James M. Landis, James McCauley Landis, the wanted first appointee, I guess, under the 33 Act to the Federal Trade Commission, and probably the first appointee to the SEC under the 34 Act, and the second chairman after Joseph Kennedy. So I'm here with you guys at your invitation. That is Jack Katz, the Secretary of the Commission, and Dan Hawk, who tells me he's a branch chief in the Enforcement Division. Doesn't look like a predator. I'm here to see if I can give you some history, some perspective, and in terms of the past. I really never had a securities practice until I joined forces with Jim Landis. He had been practicing at a firm called Landis, Taylor & Scholl, and that was with Telford Taylor and David Scholl. He also had an affiliation with a firm in Washington that was known as Landis, Cohen, Schwartz, and Rubin. But he never really was a partner in that firm. And I had been a tenant. I'd left the old Paletti Frieden firm, which later became Roosevelt Frieden and Litauer, was a single practitioner renting space from a firm, Brenner, Hannon, and Murphy, when they asked me to join the firm. But at that point, I didn't think they had the scope I was interested in. But Brenner was a former surrogate and a probate judge in Westchester County, and he had a little Westchester firm with Jim Landis, who was then the supervisor of the town of Harrison, New York, and it's called Landis, Brenner, and Bauman. And I was not interested in Landis, Brenner, and Bauman. I didn't think too well of Bauman. He let him into jail. Not that I thought that well of Brenner, but the idea of practicing law with Landis was very attractive. And so I said that if they could bring Landis in and form a New York firm, I would join them. And Landis left Telford Taylor to. That wasn't really a partnership either, but Telford never quite forgave me for it, and we formed the Landis, Brenner, Feldman, and Riley firm. That was the end of 1956, the beginning of 1957. And immediately, apart from Jim Landis's genius, and I do mean that, he was a genius in terms of his ability to assimilate facts and law like no one ever known before or since. It immediately brought me into a relationship with the Kennedys and the Kennedy family, because and I don't know how much you are interested in knowing about Jim outside of the SEC, but Jim, while at the SEC, had formed a very close relationship with Ambassador Kennedy. And after the war, when Jim was chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Board, CAB, he resigned in a fight with President Truman. Resigned, quote, fired, who knows. What happened was that under the Civil Aeronautics Act in licensing a foreign carrier because the President of the United States had the responsibility for foreign affairs. The President had to sign off. And Jim, as chairman of the CAB, held these extensive hearings as to who would be the flag carrier over the North Atlantic, TWA or Pan Am, or American Overseas. And the board awarded the franchise, subject to the President's approval, to American Overseas. And Pan Am was then run by Juan Tripp. It was very influential politically. He had a lobbyist named Sam Pryor in Washington. And the order of the commission went to the White House, and the President signed it. And immediately, the evidence clearly showed that. Immediately thereafter, Matthew Connelly, who was then the President's secretary, persuaded the President he'd made a mistake after he had met with Juan Tripp, and the President's signature was eradicated, and the award was disapproved instead of approved, and that brought on the dispute. Joe Kent, Jim was stranded. He'd been a government servant all his life, didn't know what he was going to do. And Joe Kennedy said, "Don't resign over the issue of," this was obviously hearsay on my part, getting it from Jim, "don't resign over the issue of Truman having screwed you, so to speak. You're not going to win that fight, the fight with the President. Resign because I had asked you to come to New York to represent the Kennedy interests, which were then lodged in New York." And that's what he did. And so I started practicing with him. I immediately became friendly with the Kennedy family. Jim was a trustee of a number of the Kennedy family trusts. Joe Kennedy and he were very, very close. And shortly thereafter, I mean, his relationship with the Kennedys was well known. Matter of fact, it was a problem of some contention as well, because in 1958, when the then Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts, later to become President Kennedy, had to run for re-election. Jim just took off 3 months and went up to Boston to railroad speeches and was sort of in charge of all the issues. It was that campaign which later led to his tax problems in a way, but I don't know if you're interested in any of that. Be that as it may, we started to attract in the latter, from 58, 59, it started to develop a kind of IPO practice. For some reason, in that period of time, the whole nature of the business changed. The people who had been selling vacuum, full of brushes door to door, became vacuum cleaner salesmen door to door. They became aluminum siding salesmen door to door, and lo and behold, they became broker dealers. And in the process, there were also a lot of IPOs. Initial public offerings, we didn't call them IPOs then, but they were called hot issues. And we started, for the first time, there were a bunch of new underwriters in the business, a bunch of new issuers, for the first time, the white shoe firms, the fancy law firms that had always represented the issuers and the underwriters, were not taking on this business, and we got a lot of it. And with it, we got a lot of enforcement cases. There was no enforcement division when I had my first enforcement matter. Each of the divisions had their own enforcement counsel. So that Sidney Mendelson, who later became, I guess, the head of the director of the division, the investment company. Investment Management Division. He was the enforcer in Berlin. And Loomis in Bill Loomis in Trading and Markets, and a guy named Eisenstadt. Pretty sure his name is Eisenstadt. I can't remember for the life of me his first name. Corporation Finance. What was it called? Corporation.
Yeah Finance.
Very right. And he was an assistant director of the division. And did the enforcement. And the first case I had with him, I'll forget, I later developed a good relationship with him. He was very abrupt and very peremptory, and he had asked him to see a client of mine who he thought had been guilty of some violation of the act, and a guy named Al Dworman, I believe his name was, and the woman had inherited a lot of money and was very active in the market, DWORMAN. I remember going down to Washington to visit with Eisenstadt, and Dworman being abused by him verbally, and saying, "You can't treat me that way. I'm just not some young kid on the street. I've got, I happen to be worth $33 million. I remember Eisenstadt looking him in the eye and saying, "I know. And when your father died 3 years ago, you were worth $37 million. But he was not impressed. But then we worked together on a matter. There was a matter involving somebody named Schindler, and I can't remember what the case was. My role in that was that I represented a Swiss bank through which Schindler had distributed. What's that?
Attention, attention, please. In a few moments, we will be continuing to conduct building fire drills in accordance with Local Law 5 and the New York City Fire Department. Please follow the instructions given as they pertain to your floor. Thank you for your cooperation.
Anyway, I had been retained by a Swiss private bank. I'm trying to remember the name now. I had remembered it earlier this morning. It would have come to me. That had bought some of these securities and found that they couldn't sell them. Couldn't sell them. There was a stop order, number one, and number two, that they, you know, it was an illegal distribution. The commission was unable to get any information. Eisenstadt was unable to get any information. And so, with the help and cooperation of my client, I went over and spent some time in Switzerland. In Zurich, developing information, photostatic records, and so forth, and finally being threatened with arrest for violation of the Swiss Economic Espionage Act. I remember coming back and giving act of giving, Eisenstadt the information and great, he's going to make a case. And then one Sunday morning, I was up in the country in Dutchess County, where I had a farm at the time, and I pick up the New York Times, and there's a death notice. Schindler is alleged to have died. And I called Eisenstadt. I reached him at home, and I read it to him. And I said, I know your reaction. I said, what's my reaction? How do you react? First reaction is, the son of a bitch can't do it to me. And I said, yes, I know your second reaction too. And he said, what's that? I said, you're sending up an investigator to make sure he's dead. And view him in the coffin, which he actually did. But I'm roaming.
No, this is very interesting. I'm curious. Are you, unregistered offerings in Europe are a significant problem today. How did it happen then? Do you know what the mechanics of it was? Was it the issuer that was selling overseas, or
the issuer was selling overseas? Yes, he was selling. He was selling to banks who were taking on behalf of their clients, mm-hmm. and in accounts in which the clients didn't know what they were taking or what they weren't taking, and some of those banks were taking payoffs on the side from these high binders, who were telling him, the stock's $5 and now it's $6 and now it's $7, and the famous story went around at the time when the guy says, well, I think, maybe now I ought to sell, and the broker dealer says, to whom?
Were these penny, what we call penny stocks today? Or were these legitimate companies that were?
They were reggae offerings that later, merged with some old stale shell. They were all sorts of things that never went through the registration process. Mm-hmm. Some of them turned out, to be successful, but very rarely. And they were a form of boiler room operation, but selling them overseas to some of these banks, that's... Bernie Kornfeld was getting rich on it, and so why not? Of course, you say a lot of the things that are still problems today. I'm not a practitioner in the field today. I haven't been for 20 years. But so many of the things that we thought were... the industry, or the Stan Sport and Irving Pollack thought were the cause of all sorts of problems, offerings overseas, what we call left-fielding stock, which is now called lock-up agreements. Left-fielding stock was a way of getting the stock to move, because you would put in the hands of relatives who weren't supposed to sell for 90 days until the market absorbed what they had. Now it's a lock-up agreement, and it's perfectly okay.
As long as it's disclosed.
As long as it's disclosed. So that some of the... But does that mean that it's right? Because we saw what happened with the IPOs in the 90s. So what? They disclosed a lock-up agreement with the stock... if you lock up 50% of the stock and you create a great demand, stock's going to move up, and then by the time the lockup agreement is up, they dump the stock, and it's the same manipulation, but only it became legal, and that's true with some of the overseas offerings, the so-called the theory of offering stock overseas that's not going to come back. Nonsense, it's not going to come back. Anyway, be that as
it. How do you compare the hot issues market of the late 50s to, the IPO internet bubble of a couple of years ago?
The hot issue market of the late 50s, it was by no means as dramatic or as lucrative. you know, the stock came out at $5 and went to 7.5, it was a big deal. It didn't come out at 22 and go to 106. And the hot issue market was frequently, you know, if you put the first, if you put the word uranium on it, you'd sell it. Then it had to have the word onyx, or the suffix onyx on it. But it's the same stuff.
No different than .com today.
No different than .com. I mean, it was uranium, it was mining, it was gold, it was onyx, it was aeronautics, it was, you know...
Space.
But you know, there were fashions year to year, and it was the same stuff.
When you were working on these new issues in the 50s, what was the extent of due diligence that was being done by underwriters then?
Very little due diligence. I've established my relationship with the staff of the commission by what some people said was foolish on my part. But on none of these issues would I take options. There were lawyers taking options. And I felt very strongly that there was a conflict, because I immediately became a partner if I took options. And a lot of lawyers got very rich with those options. And the staff gave me credit for that, so that in a sense my reputation was my capital. I've not regretted it by any means, but the abuses of the marketplace are no different from what they were. It's a matter of scale. What we didn't have then was, and that took a while to develop, was this business of short-term contracts for CEOs and CFOs based upon earnings, even phantom earnings, so that the incentive to goose that stock became enormous. But there was still all of the devices. I see you've listed some of the cases I was involved in. Hazel Bishop was an interesting one. Do they still talk about Hazel Bishop undertakings?
it comes up.
What that was, that Hazel Bishop was a cosmetics company that had gone public with a very small offering. And then all of the insiders got stock, and the stock was subject to registration. But either no underwriter wanted to take it on, because there were, I don't know how many selling stockholders.
There were over 100.
There were over 100. Well over 100. No underwriter wanted to take it on, and they didn't particularly want to pay an underwriter. But they registered the stock, and it was a stop order. And nobody would tell them why there was a stop order. They just said, "This is a stop order, and we'll come up with charges sooner or later, and there'll be a hearing." So I was retained to try to find out why there was a stop order. And counsel to the company at the time was a guy named Ben Javits, who was the brother of Senator Javits of New York. And Ben Javits couldn't get any answers. And Senator Javits intervened. He couldn't get any answers at that time. I went to see Manny Cohn, who was then, I guess, was he still an assistant director, or was he a director?
He would have been, the director or deputy director.
Yes, either director or deputy director.
Because it was right around when Woodside became a commissioner.
Right. And I was able to say, Manny, what's the problem, 10B4? And he said, obviously. And that was, you know, the provision of the regulation which said you can't have people selling at the same time they're buying if they're underwriters.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, these were all statutory, 211 underwriters, mm-hmm. statutory underwriters. So I said, well, we ought to be able to solve that. And he said, how? And I said, well, why don't we have an agreement among them as you would have an agreement among underwriters? And put the restrictions on them, treat them as they would be underwriters. I mean, you tell me they're underwriters, well, make them underwriters. He said, that's a hell of an idea. He said, why don't you just give me a draft of a proposal? And I did. We lifted the stop order. I got everybody to sign. We lifted the stop order. It became known as the Hazel Bishop Undertakings. And I always said to them, they should have been known as the Feldman Undertakings. But, and they were widely in use for a period of time. But it was another example of how relationship with the staff, being honest with the staff, paid off in the practice for the client.
Dana and I read Hazel Bishop, in fact, in the last couple of days, and there's something interesting about it. Maybe you can talk about it a bit, which was, it was an offering without an underwriter. It was essentially offered at the market through the American Stock Exchange. And that's not something that happens today. Can you just explain how that would work?
Well, they were all free. How did that work? You know, I'm not sure that I can. It was an offering at the market through the exchange.
So did they just list and begin trading?
Yeah.
And the price was just whatever the specialist was
quoting, that was the price, and nobody was allowed to buy while the selling was going on.
Mm-hmm.
That is, none of the selling stockholders. And
was that unusual, or was that something?
It was unusual. It was unusual. That's right. I'd forgotten that was the mechanism. It was.
I'm curious. During this period, you did a number of stop order cases with the commission, and at one point, stop orders were one of the most frequently used tools the commission had. We haven't done a stop order, I believe, in more than a year now, maybe 2 years. What do you think has happened? Why were stop orders so commonly used by the commission then? Do you have any theories? And today, they're really not.
I don't know that I do. I mean, the stop order was used in the situation where later on they started asking for amendments so as to extend the time, so that you would constantly file pro forma amendments to keep the registration, to keep the time period going. I think that was a device that came into being later. Initially, they just jumped. They did jump in with stop orders. What other stop order cases was I in?
There were a couple of the others that Dan found. I don't.
It's in the matter of Isthmus Steamship and Salvage.
That one at all.
Well, let me ask, you said that the commission issued a stop order. I said there was no advance warning to the issuer that it was coming out?
No. Not that I can recall.
Then again, that was sort of routine business.
Yeah, instead of getting a letter of comment, they call you and say, we're issuing a stop order in this case. And you say, why? Let me come down and talk to you. And they say, well, you can come down and talk, but I see you. I I have my memory on the Amos Street case. The Amos Street case is a great example of how the procedures were crazy at the time. Amos Street was a broker-dealer who must have had about 14 hot issues. He's not my client with respect to the registration of any of the issues. But when a couple of his issues went sour, one of his customers complained to the commission. And the commission looked into it and they brought a broker-dealer to see. Counsel on that proceeding for the commission was
Stuart Gordon and Sherwin
Shapiro. Stuart Gordon and who else?
Sherwin Shapiro.
And Sherwin Shapiro. And they were not used to trying a case. They were not used to the rules of evidence. Who was the hearing examiner on that?
The opinion does not.
They usually don't identify.
Indicate who the.
It was the commission's opinion.
It was by the commission, Chairman Carey and Commissioners Woodside, Whitney, and Owens. Commissioner Cohen not participated.
Well, you know the story of Commissioner Cohen not participating. they had a procedure then where if you disagreed with the ruling of the hearing examiner, you could appeal to the commission. And sometimes they'd suspend, depending on the nature of the ruling and how significant it was, they would suspend the hearing while you got a ruling from the commission. That case went on for a while because Gordon didn't know exactly what he was doing, nor did Shapiro, nor did the hearing examiner. And we got to the point, the case started, I think the hearing started perhaps in January. We're now into March, and my kid's Easter vacation is coming up, and I've got reservations to go to the Bahamas, and I want to recess the hearing for about 10 days, and they object. They won't let me do it, and the hearing examiner is now listening to the commission staff. He won't give me the adjournment. So I, furious, and I took advantage of his next evidentiary ruling to object and to appeal to the commission, because I didn't know how long it would take them to come down with a ruling. I knew that either Carey wasn't there, or who were the other commissioners?
Woodside, Whitney, and Owens.
Okay. However it worked out, I got the adverse ruling from the commission. They sustained the hearing examiner. Whereupon I asked for what the vote was. And it turned out that there was only 3 votes cast. 2 of them were not there. And one of them was Manny Cohen's. And I raised the question that he had been the head of the division at the time that some of these issues came into controversy, and therefore he should have recused himself, and there was no quorum of the commission present, and it was a violation of due process. And would you believe that I managed to get, I went down to Washington, and on that ground, got the very first injunction against a commission enforcement proceeding. The district judge was a guy named George Hart, and just a week before, he had granted an injunction against an enforcement proceeding in a case involving guy who was involved in a lot of tries for an injunction, who ran the Wall Street some Wall Street newspaper, which was a tout sheet, and he'd gotten reversed by the Court of Appeals. So he said he sympathized with my point of view, but he was not sticking his neck out again. I went right up to the Court of Appeals. I got a stay, and the Court of Appeals reversed him. In an argument with Landis and I ran, I got my vacation. People in the division were furious with me, saying, "You have ruined Manny's chances of becoming chairman. How could you do this to Manny? You're his friend, he's your friend." I said, "How could he not let me go on vacation with my kids?" Because he knew what the story was. So the Treat case later was settled. I don't know what the order of the commission was, finally.
The commission found, they approved the settlement under Section 15B.
And there was a short suspension.
17A, Section 10B, and 15C1 of the Exchange Act. And I don't know that it reflects what the sanction was. But they did find violations in, there were three issuers, Avionics,
right.
South Bay, and Magnabond.
Right.
One question that I had was, how extensive were the investigative aspects of the proceeding? In other words, how much testimony was taken, and how vigorous was the staff in seeking documents and in building the investigative record?
My recollection is that they were relying on the testimony of investors as to what they'd been told in connection with the sales. And one of their investors, who lost the most money in Avionics, that was part of the
Onyx,
sorry, was a dentist. And I asked him on cross-examination what other brokerage accounts he had. And he didn't want to disclose it. I got a ruling that he had to disclose it, and I subpoenaed his brokerage accounts. And for a little dentist in the Bronx, he had accounts at Bear Stearns, he had accounts at Merrill Lynch, he had accounts, he was just frantic. They were not prepared for that. They did not really know their witnesses. They really did not know. To put a dentist on the stand and complaining of losing $23,000 when he's got about $4 million in securities and a whole variety of accounts is not exactly a smart thing to do, when I'm sure you could have found the widows and orphans.
How long did the investigation, would a typical investigation back then in the early 1960s take?
Well, I don't know that I was talking about a typical investigation. There were those investigations that took, you know, 2 days, and you walked in and you said, "What kind of an injunction do you, you know, give me the words." And there were those, like the Chesler case, I alluded to earlier. Lou Chesler was a target. He was a target because Bobby Kennedy wanted to get Maya Lansky, and he was convinced that Lou Chesler had a relationship with Maya Lansky. By virtue of the gambling interest that he had.
Was this when Bobby was Attorney General?
Bobby was Attorney General. When I got it, Bobby was no longer Attorney General. But that had started a whole direction, shall we say. And Allie Sporkin was assigned to this investigation, and it was his first assignment. And, you know, they came up with all kinds of stuff. For instance, Chesler was a big gambler. That was a known fact. He walked in to the Colts dressing room at halftime in the Super Bowl game because he was close to the guy who owns the Colts.
Harold Rosenblum.
Harold Rosenblum.
Who was a big gambler.
Right. And he said to the team, if you guys can win this game, I'll give every one of you 1,000 shares of Universal Controls. Guaranteed against loss. All you have to do is call my broker. He'll give you each 1,000 shares. Sell them whenever you're ready to sell them. And if you lose money, call me, I'll make it up. Okay. The publicity over the fact that each of the Colts had now, quote, bought 1,000 shares, it might have moved the stock an eighth. Might have. The stock went up. Most of them made a lot of money on it. It was bought in the market. They were not his shares, although they tried to, you know, Stanley tried to show that they were his shares, not reported on the Form 4. He told his broker, sell these guys the stock, I'll finance it, and when they go to sell it, give me back my money and give them the profit. And, so Stanley was frustrated at every turn on this. He was working closely with the Justice Department. He was working closely with the Southern District. And Peter Fleming, who's just now trying the Regas case, was in the Southern District then, working on it. Pierre Laval was now on the Second Circuit, was in the Southern District working on it. Paul Grant. But it was... You know, the most they were able to get was Max Orfitz, who had been given some stock and was a director and failed to report the acquisition on the Form 4. And they thought that they would turn him, and they didn't. He served a year.
Well, they must have thought there was something else. What were their suspicions? What was it that made them...
Well, one of the suspicions that he was a market manipulator.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was tied to the mob.
Yeah. Well, did they have any evidence of that?
Of what?
Of his ties to Lansky?
Did they have any evidence of his ties to Lansky? You don't run a gambling casino in the Western Hemisphere that period of time. Do I know that he had ties to Lansky? No. Did I ever meet Lansky? No. Did I go to his hotel in the Bahamas when Mrs. Lansky was there? Yes. But, you know, as a matter of fact, when Stanley became... The day became the director, either as director or associate director of the Division of Enforcement. I happened to be in the building on another matter, and I heard the announcement, so I went up and asked to see him, and he had the Enforcement Division in his office, and they were celebrating. I walked in, and I told the secretary I was there, and I wanted to congratulate him, and he had me come in, and he said, there's the only guy who ever beat me on a case. He said, "Can you imagine where I would be today if I had made the Tesla case?" And I said, "Yes, you'd have gone from a GS13 to a GS14. I said, "How do you think you got all those promotions?" "I got you promoted off the case." He looked at me, and I was kidding him, of course, but he looked at me and he said, "I always wondered about that." The fact is, I was very useful in them. I mean, during the Kennedy administration, I was very useful in getting Manny appointed to the commission. Landis was useful in that. And during the Johnson administration, I introduced Manny to Ed Weisel, who was Johnson's personal lawyer, and who interviewed Manny and recommended him to Johnson for the chairmanship. And I've never been ashamed of that. I think he was a great chairman. Just as I think Stanley Sporkin, I think I told you over the phone, Stanley Sporkin did more for that period